Good morning. This is Disability Justice, an everyday pursuit in survival. Your host, John Griffiths.
And Dina Wilder, board operator.
With me in the studio today is Glenna Hayes and Dina Wilder. Hello and good morning. Would you two mind introducing yourselves?
Sure. I'm Dina, and I have been helping John with Disability Justice. I am a caregiver who works as a home care worker and a direct support professional, so a DSP and a HCW. So if we happen to say those terms, you'll know what I'm talking about. And I'm also the support staff for Self-Advocates Taking Action. And those are the roles I can say for this discussion today on the caregiver crisis, that those roles apply for this topic.
And Glenna, would you mind introducing yourself?
Yeah, my name's Glenna. I am also a support provider. I work as a PSW, DSP, and a home care worker. I also am the advocacy and outreach coordinator for UCP Connection, which is a brokerage that provides case management and other types of supports for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities.
Thank you two for your introductions. We had gotten such a response from the caregiver crisis episode that we had done earlier that we decided to continue on the discussion. And so right now I'm going to have a discussion with Dina and Glenna about why there's a caregiver crisis, what we can do about it, and try and get more people involved in this particular discussion. Glenna, do you mind if I start with you?
No, go right ahead.
So concerning the what I just had previously said, why do you think we're in a caregiver crisis?
I definitely think that there's multiple factors. Part of it is, in my perspective, is that society really does not support people with disabilities in a multitude of ways. And that reflects with staff pay, services, support, even the SSI and SSDI income. So I think because of society views people with disabilities, we as workers are not invested in and is continuing the oppression of people with disabilities. A lot of individuals do not view this as skilled work, which means our pay is very, very low. Most of the time we make minimum wage or just slightly above, which is not very appealing when you actually start realizing what's being asked of you by the state and other entities just to even get to the point where you're qualified to work. I know when I first started being a provider, it took about 1 month, 1 to 2 months of being unpaid before actually getting paid, which is a deterrent. So it's very layered, but I think at the very foundation of where the workforce crisis is starting is our society is not supporting and funding enough people with disabilities and their services and support due to how society views people with disabilities. And then you add on the low pay and the amount of time needed to become qualified by the state to become a worker to be paid. And then the top small layer is there's not a lot of career advancements. You don't really get good benefits, even if they say you get some type of benefits. They're really not the type of benefits that are substantial. You still end up having to pay out of pocket for quite a few things. And there's not a lot of opportunity for raises. There's no opportunities for raises. There's not a lot of opportunity for education and training and career advancement. And a lot of the time with those low wages, you don't really get the proper training and support needed to do that job. So that's just my take on it. I kind of view it as like a three-tiered cake. And the big piece on the bottom is people with disabilities are just not really supported adequately enough in our society.
Yeah, that's true. Dina, I am wondering if you would also like to answer that question.
Yeah, to just piggyback on what you said, the disability community is definitely, there's this sense of not valuing what they can provide our world. And in addition to that, caregivers are primarily women, so there's a gender inequality issue as well. So jobs that are traditionally filled by women have traditionally not been paid well. So there's inequality just across the board. And something I just want to share recently has been affecting me is there are folks in our community that are in crisis of not having caregivers. And so I have been called on because I'm so much a part of this community that I've been filling bits of time that I have to sub and be an on-call person for people that I dearly love, because they're people in my community that have helped me, like with self-advocates taking action for folks advocating for disability rights. We end up as caregivers who are devoted to this work, we end up doing those subbing. It's just like a system that just, it doesn't have an on-call or subsystem. So the people that are working in it end up doing overdoing, and they're burning us out. So I think one part of the crisis is that we don't have an on-call or subsystem, and that has to be addressed. And it's not just for the caregivers. It's just people end up in situations that are dire. They are not able to get themselves up out of bed because they have a caregiver that had a crisis and weren't able to come in. So it's just full.
And to elaborate on something you were talking about earlier, Dina, about the clients needing caregivers, would you say that in some cases, a caregiver is literally a person's life or death? Like when a person is on a ventilator and they need a caregiver to come in and constantly shift out the ventilator's parts, or switch them to a backup system so they can clean the primary one they were using and stuff like that, that when you don't have like a substitute that can step in for the person who would normally be coming in for whatever reason, but they had to leave, without this substitute system, eventually we're going to wind up seeing people die because their caregivers had to step out for one reason or another.
Yeah, I think the pandemic definitely showed us how vital our work is. But unfortunately, the bill that was proposed to help specifically direct support professional DSP wages, that bill did not get passed. So it's really kind of infuriating that when we push so hard, and they actually gave us a sense of hope about that bill, and then they didn't pass it. It's like, how long do we have to wait for our value to be understood? And it's so obvious how important the work that we do is.
And over to you, Glenna. I mean, Dina brings up a good point here that, I think it was HB 2964 would have bumped the wage up for DSPs up to, 150 plus minimum wage when it was defeated. I mean, how did that make you feel? Did that make you feel like the legislators are not listening to us?
I mean, definitely. We had countless meetings back to back with legislators on, why we need a wage increase and how it's been stagnant, and talked about the workforce shortage. And a lot of them did give us hope, saying that they would support us. But at the end of the day, they were too afraid to take a chance on budget, when the last couple of years, I believe Oregon's budget has come out pretty pristine compared to what they were forecasting. It's been pretty positive. So it was really frustrating that we once again are kind of left without the resources and funding that we need. And it's not like we're asking them to take a chance on us. You know, people forget that with the K plan and how other things work, income comes into agencies and other entities to pay their staff and their workers through people receiving services. And if we were able to have a livable wage, we would be able to support ourselves and help provide more of an economic boost for Oregon. But due to our limited amount of income, it's pretty much you have your survival needs met and you're trying to not get in more debt. But we don't have the option of doing what a lot of people in upper positions of power get to do, is they get to go out a lot. They get to go buy things for comfort and for fun. And if people in who are workers don't really have that option to go spend time for self-care. I know for me, if I had enough money, I would be able to go out to places a lot more. I'd be able to go to my chiropractor, which isn't covered under my insurance, you know, like little things like that, that help not only us, but like would be able to put back into the economy that so many people are worried about. And it's extra frustrating because it's not like we're not asking for them to take a chance on a community that's not going to utilize this. It's not like it's going to go to waste. It's going to be utilized right away. And the benefits from utilizing it are going to be huge. You're going to have more people, not just providers, but more people who receive support through their providers getting out into the community. Potentially, if they want to find employment, they can find employment, or they'll be able to go to classes. They'd be able to go to art exhibits, you know, they'd be able to do more activism. They'd be able to figure out how to do their passions and thrive in our communities. And it's kind of like a domino effect of like, when you don't pay providers and we're in a workforce shortage, people with disabilities are further isolated. So our communities don't even benefit, these other communities don't benefit from having intersectional identities in their spaces. And it's like, we talked so much about equity and inclusion over this last year, but I just see a lot of talk happening. I don't see any of that being implemented. And I think people forget that. It's like, if people who don't have enough support to barely meet their baseline of like feeding, hygiene, comfort, they're not going to thrive and be a part of other communities in any other capacity because there's no option for them to be in those spaces. And it felt like a lot of talk, and it felt like they were more concerned with keeping up their image and getting reelected rather than putting their privilege and power on the line to actually invest and support a community that has been continuously divested in my mind. And I mean, you bring up a good point about like, well, what happens if like people lack care and support, and what happens when they don't have a caregiver? One individual that I supported was really struggling to find the right amount of providers, and they did need ventilator support. And when this person called and kept calling around, like one of his main caregivers, to figure out what to do, the hospital was like, just take him to the hospital. It's not your problem. And basically said to just, his case manager said to take him to the hospital and just leave him there. And because she refused to do that, she was able to help kind of support him from avoiding that situation. But it's like, cool, so what do you want us to do? Put these individuals in group homes where they'll potentially be ignored and die? Like, or just where they live their life out in an assisted living facility without enough staff there even to be supported and thrive and to have like a life of where they thrive. And it's just like, these are human beings that are being ignored, and there's still people in positions of power who are maybe not senators and representatives, but other people in positions of power and decision-making who are making a livable wage, a wealthy wage off of this community, and not stepping up enough to deal with this workforce shortage and actually provide a livable wage, but also education and training. Like, yeah, we can have a livable wage, but what are we going to do about people who need education and guidance in these positions too? It's it's frustrating. It to me, it feels like, cool, so you don't want to step up and do what's needed. And while you're figuring it out because of all this bureaucratic red tape, individuals are suffering, individuals are dying, and individuals are being ignored and left in isolating, awful conditions, barely able to make it by. But because they're people with disabilities, you don't see that.
Yeah, I'd like to say that it sounds to me like the two of you are, and pretty much most caregivers that are dealing with people with disabilities, are being punished because they are dealing with people with disabilities. And nobody wants to see those of us with disabilities survive another day. That's why I put on this program called Disabilities Justice, an Everyday Pursuit in Survival. So, I mean, by punishing you all, they are actually punishing us as well for having a disability.
Mm-hmm. So. And further creating that isolation of a community. And like, as Dina said, like because of the workforce shortage, a lot of us are spending, the providers who are available, we can't even provide consistent support for some individuals because a lot of the time we're doing fill-in work. But we're doing so much fill-in work that we can't have a consistent schedule and be long-term for individuals because it's almost like we're a band-aid to a giant wound. You know what I mean? Like we're trying to just keep some people afloat as best we can. And it's not enough. And eventually that's going to burn out the providers that do exist because, you know, at first I feel like a few years ago when the workforce shortage started, it was an emergency, but now we're in full-blown crisis mode where people are leaving their homes, leaving certain programs because it's not enough. I've known three people who've actually left the state and moved away from their family because they can't find adequate providers and supports here in Oregon. And now it's a full-blown crisis. So what are we going to do? Like it's frustrating that this conversation has been going on so long that it went from, oh, we need to be aware of this. Oh, it's kind of an emergency to now. Oh my gosh, this is a crisis. We have so many people without support that we don't know how to even fix this issue.
Yeah. There's a Facebook page for home care workers and personal support workers here in Oregon that I've been looking at and seeing how many posts there are about the wages that have gone up for fast food industry and that how we get paid less than fast food people are getting paid now and how infuriating that is as somebody who is working to keep people alive and engaged in the community, not to devalue the work of people who work giving people food, but it's the inequality and it's capitalism.
Well, it's profit versus people is what it is. Is what you're talking about right there is profit versus people. McDonald's is got great big huge lobbyists, things like that. And it's you know you guys are helping out the people, but McDonald's is helping out somebody's pocketbook, and that's a real problem.
It is. It 100% is in lots of areas, not just, I mean, in general, putting profits before people in any context is pretty awful. And I was having this discussion the other day with somebody. All jobs are skilled jobs because people have to develop, they have to have the skills to do that job. Like if you're a fast food worker, you got to be able to multitask, time your stuff, work in a hot kitchen, make sure that your customer service skills are up, sometimes know how to count money, maybe man multiple stations. Those are skills I don't possess. So I think that's where we also need to recognize is like these, we all deserve a livable wage, no matter what our job is, because it is a skilled job. Our skills are just different. And it doesn't mean any other skilled job is less or more valuable. It's we're all human beings that are doing a job and we deserve to be paid for that job. And it would be nice that we'd at least make a livable wage, especially because before they capped, I don't know if y'all remember this, but before we switched over to the K plan, we didn't have a cap on how many hours we could work. Like we didn't have like the 40 hour max. I was working 60 hour weeks just so that I could make a livable wage. Right. And now the K plan and the state, the federal government came in and was like, well, the state's the employer, not the individual. You know, we're all capped on our hours that we can work too. So it's not even an option for us to work overtime or work multiple jobs in the same field. So it's like, there's another barrier for us. And that also messed up a lot of people's supports. Like the person that I was working with, I worked with them 5 days a week, 10-hour shifts, because that's what they needed to, you know, go to their meetings, get up, have lunch, drive back, be aware of traffic. And then at the end of my shift, you know, we would swap over. And when they did that, he had to change his whole entire routine. He had to quit committees. He had to quit a lot of different other things, because the way that the shifts were structured, it wasn't an option for his needs. And I think people forget that too. It's like, we are all skilled workers, but our skills and our labor force need to be treated very differently than others, because we're, a lot of our jobs are interconnected to supporting other people's lives. And we need the flexibility and support needed for those individuals to have a flexible life that we all have. It's frustrating that, you know, we talk about wages and we also are missing the conversation. I think what connected to wages and adequate pay is able-bodied people and neurotypical people who can work jobs get flexibility and freedom to have an unscheduled day, to change their day halfway through. But when you have supports or no supports, you don't get that. You don't get that choice. Mm-hmm. You don't get that freedom to be flexible and be like, oh, I have nothing to do after 2 p.m. I get to go off and do whatever I want. Because you have to either have it scheduled with a support, or if your support's already scheduled, you can't just cancel on them because then you risk losing them.
Right. Yeah, I'd just like to say that, you know, listening to both you and Dina, that it seems to me like the government's trying to commit genocide of people with disabilities. They're just trying to bump us off by, you know, causing difficulties for you all to work and make a living wage and have appropriate benefits and stuff like that. By getting rid of you all, they will essentially get rid of a large sum of us as well.
Mm-hmm. Or be forced into institutions. I know some people really like living in like a roommate group home setting, but when it's not a choice, that's forced institutionalization. And just because it's capped on how many people can be in that home doesn't make it any less of an institution. And it's kind of like you said, I feel like they are trying to commit genocide on a community that has already gone through a genocide. I mean, when you look through certain points of history, that people with disabilities are always kind of the target group for a lot of harm. And it's frustrating that because people think that we have people like, oh, well, we have ADA, we have the Americans with Disability Act. That doesn't mean squat. Like that is a small blip in a whole minefield of issues for people with disabilities. And it's, you know, we lack the education in schools. I mean, in my generation, Emily, I turned 33 this year. My school was segregated. People with disabilities were up in a trailer on a hill, far away from anybody else, even though we had accessible classrooms. And it took a lot of work internally for me to unbox all that ableism that I was taught, not only through society, but through my schools. And it's like, I think that we need to stop segregating classrooms for people with disabilities. And we need to start educating people at a younger age how to be more inclusive, how to address their ableism, and making sure that like we're providing education on the history of disability justice. A lot of people, again, think of that one, the ADA, and they go to that every single time. And it's like, we've fought long and hard in multiple ways. Like I think it's still 38 states still have institutions. I think 5 states still use the R word in their actual policies and state papers. So if you're an individual trying to access services, you'll see the R word in your paperwork. it's such a vast systemic issue that we focus so much on the wages being increased, and we forget that there's so much attached to that wage increase. That means we're going to have more skilled providers. That means we're going to have more providers available. That means the more that we have those things, people with disabilities are going to be able to access communities a lot differently. They're going to be able to access higher education if that's what their goals are. It's so frustrating that, like, when we were talking to those senators and representatives, they really only saw the financial impact and the budget rather than recognizing that these are people's lives. And we are doing a lot of harm out here by not addressing this issue.
This is really big. This is really important.
Yeah, John, you and I have been talking about how to bring attention to it. And that's something that I am so ready to do some action around it.
Just thanks for this conversation. And I hope it sparks a lot of other conversations within people's personal lives. And maybe getting out there and getting active, maybe checking self-advocates taking action out on Facebook and joining us in some of the advocacy work that we're trying to do.
Yeah, self-advocates taking action. That is a group of individuals with IDD, meets from 11 to 1, second Friday of the month and fourth Friday of the month. And at the present time, we're meeting over Zoom. I'd like to thank Dina and Glenna for having this discussion with me. Thanks, Dina.
Yeah, thanks for getting the word out that there is a crisis and we all need folks to get out there in different ways trying to get this changed.
And thank you, Glenna, for coming in and talking with us about this.
Thank you for holding space for this conversation.
That's the end of Disability Justice. Since we cannot be fully aware of everybody's difficulties within the community, we would really like it if you would send us your email, disabilityjustice@kbu.org.